We talked about the first three lines of this yesterday, and actually about the title or his word for this practice, Silent Illumination. But I kind of wanted to back up a minute from that and kind of ask why we're here. And to answer my own question, I feel that each of us have discovered something, and it's what brings us here. When you wake up to this mystery, even the possibility of a mystery, things change. You can't escape it. Some apparent physical discomfort for this way of being together, sitting. But it's also a kind of relief because there's a mental or emotional relief. A lot of work to keep our reality constructed, and when we come here, there's this format that we can merge with, that we don't have to keep creating what's next. And this thing that we discover, that we initially discover and continue to unfold, is it's just life. It's this existence that we keep arising in. And to come together like this is to align ourselves with that. This isn't, I'm going to say, like, the way that we're doing it is slightly altered from the way it was done 600 years ago, but it's essentially the same realization is being transmitted through a variety of means. Sometime I want to talk about the roles of the temple, because it has a lot of information in those. With this format, so to speak, our whole focus becomes directed towards what we call the way, this Buddhist way, or the Buddha way, or just the path. And something I find myself repeating seemingly continually is that we wake up to this mystery, this thing that we know. It's not so mysterious, but as it unfolds, we realize it's none other than Buddha mind. Everything is continually emerging from Buddha mind. There's ultimately nothing other than this, other than Buddha mind. And all the things that we do are contrived from the fabric of Buddha mind itself. There are two things that are spoken of, and one is compassion. Of course, we know this word, and this feeling brings us here also. Compassion towards our own condition evolves into compassion towards the overall condition. How wonderful it is to pull the veil back and see this incredible sight, and we want to share it with everybody, everything. And with that kind of discovery, there's this vow, sense of vow to uphold it, and it comes from respect and a lot of things. Thank you, Coben. Thank you, everybody, going back, for constantly breathing life into this, so that we had the opportunity to hear. Even though we had this inner grasping feeling of what's going on, and so we vow to continue this way. Our whole life is directed this way. It may not seem like it, because you think, well, I'm doing carpentry and I'm not doing the Buddha way, but that's not the case. Regardless of what you're doing, with this opening, this realization and awakening, whatever you're doing, you can't forget. And this kind of with that kind of feeling of compassion and this vow, it fuels our intention. So we can let go of trying to accomplish something, because the intention is set. We can't, even if we're on a windy road, we can't get away from it. And I think it's important to note in our tradition that there's a distinct emphasis on everyday life as being inseparable from our practice, whatever form that takes. For some, it's in the midst of a busy city, and for some, it's retreating somewhere. And again, as this practice unfolds, there's a sense that, or a conviction, understanding, and insight into the fact that this is it. This is what you're looking for. There's no need to go anywhere else. And in that way, our place of practice is never exceeded. Wherever we are, it's ongoing. Opportunity, unfolding, realization. Somewhat this line, Hongzhi says, just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. There's so much information in here. he says this, or the deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. It's a lot of things, but this way, one way of looking at that is that in the midst of whatever activity or state of mind you find yourself in, this original mind is allowed free and mingles and interacts with all apparent dharmas, little d dharmas, and yet is not not swayed by they arise, but there's no confusion about grabbing them or them pushing you, or it's just a kind of joy to see all the Buddha mind arising and observed by Buddha mind, all in the midst of this original nature is sparkling in itself. Does anybody else have a favorite line or something they would like to add?
I was reflecting on the first three lines yesterday, and for me what came up was that there's something about confidence. Once you experience a knowing of what, as he said, this is and that is, or that is that, and this is this. I always am asking, especially like the second or third day, Shishin, you know, why am I here? I'm like, you know, why am I here? What keeps us on the seat here? So for me, it's something about like a faith or self-confidence. Not so much about self-confidence, but the faith that it's so much bigger than myself, this self, little self. And it just softens everything for me, knowing that one thing that comes up for me, helps me a lot, is knowing that everybody's doing the best they can do. I know I'm doing the best I can do at this moment, and other people are too. And it's part of that nature that we all have it. And for me, knowing that, again, it's this kind of this faith that all is fine in the world. It is just what it's meant to be, and it's nothing personal. It didn't happen to me for a certain reason. And that's what I've just been reflecting again on the clearness of it. Trip myself up all the time about boundlessness, emptiness, but visualizing the whole or this original nature that we all have. I always like the term, what Trungpa used was basic goodness. Yet, I may have just answered it myself, thinking that at times when I do act out at home and act out here, or act unskillfully, or act the best I can at the time, and feel bad about it, or don't think it's very skillful. I guess that's when I forget about this type of faith, or forget about the bigger thing. I think it was Reb Anderson who said once that. You're breaking the bodhisattva vows when you have self-doubt. That's just was my reflection on three lines. Do you have anything more? Faith isn't something we talk a lot about. With the self-confidence. Suzuki Roshi, well, Koban, I know in that one quote that we handed out in a little card 5 years ago, didn't it say the precepts? Said when we don't, we're not following the precepts, we're lacking our self-confidence. Remember that little, something like that?
Sorry.
I think somebody did.
Yeah.
Plugged
that
somewhere.
That's, of course, what he said, Can I ask you, when I was reading the little bio, about your little bio, it said that you started going to Haiku Zendo when you were in your teens.
19.
How old?
19.
19. I was 40. No, late 30s. How in heck did you know to do that at such a young age? It certainly took me many decades, of running around in circles.
I don't know. Karma, I suppose. It was like once I went that way, I ran into Koban and never deviated, just to the cushion and there was but a good friend of my mother's was Maria Wallace, and so I remember years before her talking to my mother about practice. One time I overheard them, and she was obviously very passionate about some experience she'd had and was relating it to my mother. And so when I had the inclination to sit, I called her and ended up at Haiku Zendo on a Wednesday night with Buff Bradley giving me Zazen instruction, and we sat two periods. And I remember her sitting the first few minutes and went, this is right. And then turned around and Koban Gate was there and gave a talk. I just kept coming back. And I dragged all my friends one by one there, and none of them came back. Try it, and they're like, okay, whatever.
I think it's really amazing. Because people in their teens are... Well, I have two grandsons now, you know, 15 and 17. I kind of discourage them from coming near here because I just... I think they'll sit one sitting and never come back. And certainly I would have, you know, when I'm 30.
Yeah.
So that's really... I somehow need to understand. No, I don't. I'd like to understand what it was, you know, that you sat 10 minutes and you knew this was it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Astonishing.
There must be other people. There's some young people.
The line that's actually, there's two lines that is coming out at me. The first one is, just expand and illuminate the original truth unconcerned by external conditions. To me, that's just reiterating Bodhidharma's the mind never waxes or wanes, but conditions change. And basically, it says... regardless of the external conditions, whether it's really good or it sucks, stay connected to your Buddha nature, to that truth. And I don't know if that's what it's really saying or not.
Well, the one piece of that that... First of all, it's continuing, for one thing. To expand and illuminate the original truth means that you're...
Continuous path.
Continuing your path.
Yeah.
To continue, ongoing. And, regardless of what's happening, you're in the midst of it.
Right.
On the one hand, it could read as, you know, regardless of whether you're having a good day, a bad day, or bad life, you still do this, almost like you're unconcerned. You're kind of brushing aside the conditions. But I also think it's he's not quite saying it in this sense, but it's external conditions are no different than it's not, there's no inside outside, it's this permeable state. Inside and outside are the same. The next line, we are told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. It's before mental cognizance. When we just sit without any gaining idea, we're not giving birth to anything. We can see light change, but we don't say the branch is swaying.
In the circle of brightness, a couple people here know my story. I've been really raging against the light for a good number of years. And, you know, the darkness at the bottom leaves me wondering, is this where I'm going to be? You know, I want to run from here. And yet words like stop resisting and enough and welcome home. I mean, I've been here before, 18, 19. It's been a long time. So yesterday when I heard this grinding down and, you know, listening and slowing down, I had to stop asking why I dug so deep, and as I'm punching holes in the ground today, digging, it's the first time my mind's been quiet in a long time. So, and I just, still wondering, you know, and listening to others has been beneficial. Appreciate the support I've gotten here. This is timely.
Well, just like Donna Lynn's bringing up faith, there's also effort. Yeah. And there's a point, you know, you have to keep pushing until you get beyond the point of backsliding. And even though there's this kind of everything's even Stephen, you know, there is also good and bad, or altruistic and selfish behaviors. It's been a question of mine, is where does compassion come from? Where does it begin? You know, sometimes realizing the source of all things, but the word compassion never really arose. I read about it, and it's not that I don't have it, it's just that I don't quite, like, looking for the germ of it. Where does it come from? But you feel it, you know, I think. And anger is a form of compassion. It's maybe even like all the way around, but like in the yin-yang symbol, each one has a dot of the other as its germ for changing into the other. Because I remember, just on a personal note, I remember being young and being like life was golden. Literally, when I think back, it was like golden time. And then it went into hell, into dark, dark place. Not of my own making, but I ended up in the midst of this hell realm, and yet there's I say not of my own making, but maybe karmically, but I didn't go do things to make it that way. It just, like, as a child it occurred, but discovering this way of being, this sitting, that's why I say that word compassion. I mean, it's a feeling, not so much something that I suddenly came out and verbalized compassion, but this realization that there's some other way. It's like, wow, it's like wanting to bring my friends to sit. compassion for them. I hope you can find it for yourself.
I really like this poem. It speaks to, and kind of how you bring it up speaks to, I feel like, what my practice has been like, for the focus of my practice for the past while. For some time, it's that faith in myself or in the practice or in just being present to my life in a skillful way. But then also, then like to feel the need for effort, you know. And, you know, it's like this, there's these dual burning desires in me. One is to fully realize the reality of the Dharma, you know, that emptiness. And then at the same time, to fully realize being skillful as a human being, you know. And so there's been times when I've gotten frustrated with the practice, or I guess just ways of speaking about it, where I feel like, you know, there's not an emphasis put on, I guess not enough for me, not an emphasis put enough on sitting zazen in a really deep way, or practicing acknowledging the precepts, or you know, like the fundamentals of our practice, were, because a lot of times, like I heard you say, in our tradition, it's that kind of silent illumination, or that everything is that. And so there's oftentimes I'll hear, and I'll catch myself doing it, kind of like talking about everything is Buddha nature, everything is the mind, that Buddha mind, and that it's all okay, that faith part, right, that everything's okay. And then at the same time, in my experience, it isn't, you know. It's like, and I kind of like, you know, use a metaphor that, you know, yeah, well, if everything is that, that's great, like, you know, but it doesn't help the guy in traffic who's, you know, opposed to others around him, and he's freaking out. Because the reality is that he's one with everything in his experience, but then his relative reality is that these damn people won't speed up, you know. So,
is that you?
What's that? Are you not speeding up?
Are you the one that's railing?
Well, I think that, I mean, definitely at some point it has been, but, I guess it's more of, I mean, what do I care about other people's practice? But I do at the same time, you know. I, for some reason, I care about things being illuminated to the best of their ability, or spoken about as clearly as possible. And, you know, I would say that's probably like my own searching, that my own desire for truth, that, you know, runs up against that. But I guess what I'm saying is I appreciate that addressing both sides. And, like, you know, I found that I wouldn't be able to do this practice. I wouldn't be able to keep coming back to it if I didn't have that faith, you know. And then I also feel like I wouldn't grow if I didn't take it seriously and not just say it's all Buddha mind, but say there's some work to be done. I gotta chisel away at this guy.
Have reality to conform to how you want it to be. And there's definitely foundational work in Buddhist practice. Unfortunately, in this tradition, it's kind of like somebody puts you in and fires you off into space. You don't know what's going on. There's no apparent steps to take, you know. Just get launched out of a catapult. Poof! off the edge of a cliff, no less. And so it's kind of like James Bond or something, or you have to, you know, do something right away because it's a dire situation. Mm-hmm. Or you can maybe at Tassajara or Zen Center or something, you'll find those steps. They're there. And Doug was reminding me today at work period that there's all of that stuff that is foundational that you are bringing up is important, but I think in this style, shall we say, that through the realization of your true nature, I mean, not intellectual realization of it, but deep penetrating realization of it, which is through, in our case, through shikantaza, through this type of sitting, but also even when you stand up and start moving around, through that, there is one realization, and all of those things come spilling out into fully formed into place, like light shining through a prism. Those colors, that spectrum, is all of that information is coming from this clear, bright light of your true nature. And it sounds not easy, you know, but it's... Or you can go and read and study and practice red, blue, green and find your way that way back. But that information comes out of enlightened mind. It is an aspect of this right now. Those elements are all there. And I'm reminded now that in another talk that I was using the example of the circus person and they spin the plate and they have it on a pole and before you know it they have like 12 of them. You know? So all that's going on all the time. And every once in a while you have to go, oops, I gotta get that one going again. You can look at it like that, too. There's tremendous amount of information out there. Sometimes I read one of these and it makes my brain go ping, 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 because I'm like, remember other, like somebody said, this reminds me of Bodhidharma as well, and like that. But you have the opportunity and the time to study those things as you go along. But without this type of... I think this Zen practice is a very advanced practice, actually, and we're thrown right into the middle of it. Like you... Suddenly you're in the Indy 500 when you're just learning to drive, you know. And you have to discover and learn and catch up. But at the same time, it's like it's okay. You can just be how you are. Don't have to stress about it. But it creates a kind of pressure. It's like the Han, you know. Without the Han... Everybody individually is like, oh, I've got about 5 minutes. But with the Han, it's like driving everybody. It's like herding you to the Zendo. There's that kind of pressure going on because we're catapulted out into the midst of this vast array of information less space. You know? I'm supposed to just sit here, stare at the wall. But obviously, it feels right, or you wouldn't keep coming back. I hope that helps.
Still is
that. That's what Doug brought up. At his ordination, I said, I was helping Mike, but I said, remember, there's only one precept. And that's,
what is it? I forgot it.
Just keep sitting, Doug.
I've been thinking about what we were talking about yesterday, and I almost didn't notice it at the time, but this, where he says, you must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. And that sentence, I was going over and over that, you know, since we talked about that sentence in general, and then I found myself recognizing that word apparent in there, and I was wondering if you had anything else to add on that. I found myself really pushing into that with myself, apparent habits, because I get really, and it's funny you were talking about the backsliding, the place of no backsliding, and as I reflect over the past, it's like 5 years of practice. It's been, I feel like these intense bursts of efforts. And actually, I remember talking to you in New Mexico, and you were saying something similar about the way you used to practice, really intense sesshin. And then I just immediately, you know, whatever, any, you know, if there is such a thing as merit that I've accumulated, I just, you know what I mean? And so I feel like I've just been doing these like big bursts and then just sort of like, and fall right back into all my old habits. And so I find myself constantly more and more in this, this struggle against, you know, my impulses and these habits and what are they? And but then at the same time, I know Zen warns about not getting too caught up in this idea of purity. And I always remember that there's this correspondence, these letters written between, it was a nun and a Zen master, and I can't remember his name. Was it Basu, maybe? Was he the guy that slept in trees? And she was saying, oh, I'm getting ready to fast for a week or something. And he wrote back and he said that the true fast that you should do is letting go of your ideas of purity and impurity. So don't fast, but fast from your ideas of fasting. And so I find myself wondering, as the chocolate chip cookies are coming around, well, I shouldn't have a sugary cookie in the middle of sesshin. I should just be eating plain oats. And I mean, that's just a smaller thing, but that is in everything that I do. Because I want to do this right. You know what I mean? Like Abhijit said, I really want to do this the right way. And time and time again, I've seen myself get caught right back up in the flypaper. So, but then that word apparent kept jumping out, and so I just wanted to ask you about that.
Well, the dualistic mind is the thing that is the key to what you were saying about whether you should have a sugary cookie or not. You just take what's offered and eat it without judging it. But I think that word apparent, I was talking about it yesterday, was key to that sentence. But we have this format, this way of coming together like this, and it creates an energetic imprint on you. And if you don't resist it, then those habits are formed, they're directed. There's a lot of aspects to your question. And it'll take time for you to see. But I think both of you are talking about these foundational practices. And it's something where you kind of have to work closely together, but like Era in New Mexico wanted to be the Tenzo right away. He was very excited about the Tenzo position, likes to cook and so on. And I told him no, which was a little disappointing to me because we badly need a Tenzo, you know, somebody who really wants to be a Tenzo. But after maybe almost 5 years, he persisted in cooking and studying about being the Tenzo and embodied or began to embody what being a Tenzo means. And so I asked him to please be the Tenzo after that. But it's because he went through those foundational things and he cleared some of his desire about, his personal desire about being in that position. And one more thing. And in the midst of being angry sometime, just stop and look at what you're doing. Think of it as a habit, as an example of a habit. And so when you catch yourself in the midst of something like that, being angry, think about who is it? You're usually defending yourself, you know, being self-righteous or kind of like, I'm right. And if you can stop that and just breathe and let there be space around it, see what happens. Instantly, you do it right away, as soon as it comes up, as soon as you realize you're doing that. And pay attention so that you do. Because that's that word apparent. You'll see why he uses that word.
In the lines it says, utter emptiness has no image, and upright independence does not rely on anything. To me, as I understand emptiness, it's that everything is so interconnected that nothing is independent, and so we call that emptiness. And then the next line seems to say the opposite. Upright independence does not rely on anything. I don't really understand that line at all, what he's trying to say.
Well, that first part, utter emptiness has no image. There's no... He's using poetry in a sense, but you can't conceive of it. Somebody said to me before coming out here, left me a phone message. We had some business, but he sits also and he says something like, hope you go and realize there's nothing there, or something like that. And I disagree because there is something there. But if you call it something, that's not it. And if you say there's nothing, it's not it, and so on. There's the four-point logic that Nagarjuna uses, for example. But, I mean, to say utter and to say no image are pretty powerful words.
So to me, it seems like he's saying the two extremes, the absolute extremes.
You know, he's talking about the absolute, yeah. Utter emptiness, the absolute. And it's not emptiness like black space. Like, it's not nothing. It's empty. Empty in that it defies description. It doesn't have a dualistic quality to it. There's nothing to hang your hat on, so to speak. And this is where the grasping comes into play, because as soon as we... I have an idea. Now everything's split. We're not in this unconceived reality anymore. Yet, if you know this underlying reality, this utter emptiness, then you realize that everything arises from it, as the example of the ocean and the wave caps. And this upright independence does not rely on anything. It's to conform to that that state, there's nothing to rely on. You just appear without a ripple.